Have you been listening to the podcast and getting value from the show? If so, I've got a small favor to ask, because over the next few months, we're going to be making some changes to better serve you. Now, I could keep creating episodes based on what I think would be most helpful, but I would much rather get this right. So instead of guessing, I want to understand where you are right now and the real challenges you, your organization, and your team are facing. That's why I've put together a very short 90-second survey. It'll help me better understand you and how I can serve you at a much higher level. And as a thank you, the first 30 people who complete it will receive a free signed copy of one of our books. To take part, just go to the show notes and click the link titled Leadership Survey. Or you can go directly to letsgrowleaders.com/podsurvey. PODSURVEY. It'll take less than 2 minutes. I really appreciate your input. It will genuinely help shape the future of the show.
You're going to have critics. You're going to have people that are going to disagree with you. And your job may not be to convince all of them to turn your way. You may not need all the votes, for example. But the thing you should never do is blindside your critics. So when I was going to disagree with someone in an important meeting, I made a point of it to sit down with my PowerPoint with that person one-on-one ahead of time, that they knew I wasn't going to blindside them or stab them in the back in front of a leader, even if we disagreed. And that goes really, really far towards building relationships over years, because you never know. I mean, boy, have we learned this, where one person that you stab in the back one day, what sort of role they're going to have next year or in 5 years, and how you're going to have to face them again.
Hey, it's David, and you're listening to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, your source for practical leadership inspiration, tools, and strategies you can use to achieve transformational results without sacrificing your humanity or your mind in the process.
Hey, welcome everyone. So glad that you're able to join us. I am so excited to bring you today's guests with a plural. We've got co-authors with us today, a fantastic pair, very, very bright people who have tackled a subject that isn't the first word you think of when you think of human-centered leadership. We're talking today about bureaucracy, specifically how to hack your bureaucracy. That's the title of their latest book. It's just out. It's called Hack Your Bureaucracy, Get Things Done No Matter What Your Role on Any Team. So I know that's going to be of interest to everyone today. So let me introduce our guests today. We've got Marina Nitza, who's a fellow at New America's New Practice Lab, where she works on improving America's foster care system, and previously served as a senior advisor on technology in the White House, Obama administration. She was the chief technology officer for the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs under President Obama as well. And we have with us Nick Sinai, who's a senior fellow at Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs and a senior advisor at Insight Partners, a venture capital and private equity firm. Nick served as U.S. Deputy Chief Technology Officer in the Obama White House, and prior to that played a key role in crafting the National Broadband Plan at the FCC. Easy for me to say, right? Marina and Nick, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks, Dave.
Oh, absolutely. And it's our pleasure. I am so excited to get into this book, Hack Your Bureaucracy. One of the most intriguing titles to come across my desk. As you imagine, I see a lot of books, read a lot of books, and this one certainly caught my eye. And I got to say, listeners, you know how I am with some of the books and resources we have. And I got to tell you, this is a treasure. I think you're going to want to get a copy of this, and we're going to dive into it. But before we do, so that we can learn a little bit about who each of you are, and Marina, I'm going to give this one to you first, and then Nick, I'll come to you. If you could take us back to your earliest memory of yourself as a leader, what would that be?
Oh, earliest memory as a leader. It would probably be when I was first in the city of Seattle, and I saw that the city was putting out a $20,000 prize for the best app that could use open data. And I remember thinking, like, that doesn't seem like the best use of those taxpayer dollars, because $20,000 isn't really enough to put an app into production, right? And so other things could be used better for that money. And so as a regular everyday citizen that didn't know anybody or had any special connections, I applied to join the board, the community-based board that was overseeing the money. I was accepted. I then applied to run the committee overseeing the money, and I was appointed. And then I changed the prize instead of being a prize at all to invest in a bunch of community-based events that brought the city and individual startups in the community together. And so I think that was the first time that I understood the power of leadership and what one person who doesn't necessarily have any particular power can really accomplish.
Holy cow. I love that story for so many reasons. I empathize with some of it, some of my own work in local government. And gosh, that tells us right away what power we have as individuals, even in looking at a bureaucracy or all of the things that are there. Okay, we'll get into all that. Nick, you're up. Earliest memory of yourself as a leader.
Well, you know, I had a pretty conventional management consulting start to my business career. And I remember one time I got denied a promotion. I was just maybe a senior analyst hoping to be an associate. So still pretty early in my career. And I was rolling my eyes too much at superiors who I did not respect. And I apparently did not have enough of a poker face. And so I remember getting this, like, you're great with Excel. You're great with PowerPoint. You're great with clients. You're driving home all the analytical work, but you're rolling your eyes at some people in the firm. And so it was clear that I did not have that emotional maturity, and I was not projecting that emotional maturity. I was in my earlier mid-20s at the time. And I thought about it. I took that to heart and worked on not only not rolling my eyes, but actually having more empathy for those senior leaders who were thrown into an organization who maybe didn't have the at-bats that I had with the subject matter or with a particular client and so forth. And so some of my disdain for them that I was not concealing well was the fact that I had been doing the same project over and over again. And so I had become a little bit of a master. If you fast forward, I then was a young manager, and I was managing people without, I didn't have an MBA, but I was managing people we were hiring out of business school. And so that was a really interesting experience where I had to grow because these people were often 5 or 10 years older than me. And yet I was having to manage them. And I think that really forced some additional emotional maturity there.
Oh, and once again, you know, the lessons that we learn early and the way that those transform and carry through. And I can see both of the streams of your life experience and how they have informed and influenced the work that you've done in and through bureaucracies that you share with us in the book. So fantastic. I love that, Nick, that the empathy, the disdain that we, you know, so it's easy to have for leaders when we don't understand what's going on, and the empathy and compassion that maybe you're able to develop and that we need, because things don't always, they look a lot different. We're on that other side of the desk, don't they?
Yeah, very well put.
All right, well, let's get into hack your bureaucracy. So get things done no matter what your role on any team. And in the promotional language for this book, listeners, I love, they talk about, listen, if you're frustrated by your homeowners association or a neighborhood group or something like that, all the way to you're working in a multinational global organization that's matrixed and just this monolith, or in government, there's so many applications for what we're going to be talking about. So I want to start with a definition of terms, because we hear the word bureaucracy, and that means different things to different folks, and it has a life to it, that word. So let's start by, what the heck do we mean? What do you mean talking about a bureaucracy?
You know, we're really just talking about an organization of any size that has rules, that has officials, that has subject matter expertise. And so people tend to think of bureaucracy as a negative word, but really it is the standard application of a process in an organization. And so that can be public sector, it can be private sector. And so people think of government agencies as bureaucracies. But the way you get an Amazon package, or the way Google search works, or there's so many things that have a system to them. There are bureaucratic theorists and scholars, and so we did a little bit of background research on this, not to bore your listeners, but a bureaucracy has officials who act out of impartiality, right? So that is whether you're a corporate executive, a corporate officer, or whether you're in a large nonprofit or university, hospital, whatever, what you're doing is for the best of the mission and the goals of the organization, right? And you're treating whether it's your cases or your beneficiaries or your customers, you're trying to treat them with a level of impartiality, and there is a subject matter expertise to you know, like there's some expertise in that organization. So really, anything can be bureaucratic, like your homeowners association, a nonprofit, corporations are definitely bureaucracies as well.
So, yeah, in the course of writing our book, we tried to find something that wasn't a bureaucracy. This search led us to like a co-op grocery store in Berkeley, California, and other places. And it turns out it absolutely was also a bureaucracy there. So I think we're all operating in bureaucracies, whether we want to be or not. And so part of the book is saying, you know, we can't get out of the bureaucracies. We all exist in them. So how do you work within them and make them work for you?
You know, when we're doing anything collectively as human beings that's repeatable, there are those systems, those rules, those the elements that ideally, done well, exist to serve our client, our customer, our service, our citizen, our constituent. So that's what I hear you using. So let's get to why we have the negative connotations and why you needed to write a book called Hack Your Bureaucracy. What's going on there?
Yeah, the book really started because we kept observing the people around us that would be new to the bureaucracies we were working in at the time, which is the White House, and in my case, the VA. And everybody's initial reaction would be, we've got to just blow this up. We've got to just get rid of it, go around it, go through it, get an exception. And we just have never seen that work. What does work is what we saw people that were actually, you know, playing the bureaucracy like a musical instrument. They knew exactly how to get things done. And there's a perhaps not an exact science, but like it's more than an art to it. And so we saw these lessons, we applied them, we saw them work in some of the hardest, toughest, seemingly impossible to move organizations in the world, like the White House, the Department of Defense, et cetera. And then we kept seeing them work everywhere else, schools, PTAs, condo associations, et cetera. And so that's what really sparked us to capture all these tactics and stories and share them.
We did have a whiteboard in the Obama White House, and we had a bunch of sayings that we put down, and some of them were ones that I think your listeners would have heard before, like don't waste a crisis, or you can get more done if you don't care who gets credit. There are other ones that were super helpful and maybe a little bit more specific to the White House, like White House tribes. And we talked about the hacks versus the wonks. And I was a wonk because I was an MBA and you know, I had business expertise and surrounded by a lot of scientists and technologists in the CTO's office and the Office of Science and Technology Policy. But there's a lot more hacks, you know, people who came from the campaign trail and so forth, and people who were advising on political strategy. And understanding this hacks versus wonks dynamic was important to understanding how to actually get things through. If you're trying to get a policy through, the hacks may actually care more about the optics of how the message goes out and what the president, where the president is visiting when he or she is saying that particular message, and less about the nuance of the policy details. And so understanding hacks versus wonks on that whiteboard was something important to us, understanding these different tribes, or as we in the book we call it guilds, because that's important in any organization, is really trying to understand the different groups that people are in. And if you can build these authentic, trusting relationships, which was another thing we had on that whiteboard, with people in other groups inside your organization, you can get a lot more done.
And that it strikes me that the hacks and wonks, I mean, that dynamic and the guilds that you mentioned, those do exist in every organization. You've got people who, with a particular decision, are going to be concerned about the optics and how it plays and what's going to happen there, and then others who are more concerned about the data and the and they're not, neither of them are right or wrong. They're both important things, both important elements of getting something done, right?
Yeah, I mean, think about marketing versus accounting, right? And so you're going to be much more comfortable if you're a marketer to spend time with other marketing professionals. But if you actually build authentic, trusting relationships, build on a mutual understanding of reality, with some of the accountants, your ability to get resources to do that big marketing campaign, to do something that requires the buy-in, maybe it's a multi-year investment, And so you really have to build that trust with that other guild of accounting. So I think this is true in any organization, is you're going to have these different guilds, and it's just natural to congregate because you spend most of your time in your particular function. And even as leaders, you may spend time with the other leaders, but you may not spend time with the rank and file in another group, right? And so that's harder to do, of course, but it gives you a better appreciation and empathy. And ultimately, those relationships are what allow you to not only get things done, but also to reform, improve, change the rules of your organization, of your bureaucracy, so that we can all do more important things to come.
I think building on that, a tactic that we outline in the book, but one that I use all the time, every day in work, is really building out your stakeholder map. I think too many people look at their org chart and believe that is how decisions are made based on who reports to whom. And sometimes that's true. And certainly sometimes that's a factor, but really you want to think through, like, who are all the different stakeholders and what are their risks and incentives? You know, if you want a certain change made, how is each person going to react to that? And from where are they reacting from? Is it, you know, fear for their job? Do they want recognition? Do they not want recognition? Do they want budget? Do they want to be seen associated with something that's effective? Do they not want to be seen associated with change? Do they want to be viewed as someone that's sort of like the stalwart, dependable, reliable person where things don't change? And people have lots and lots of different incentives, and they're usually really honest about what they are if you ask them. And so I think this is something people don't do nearly enough, that we definitely want to encourage more people to think about in the process of making change in whatever their bureaucracy is.
All right. So getting practical here, just I want to highlight what you said there. So we have this concept of, if you want to get accomplished change in any organization, relationships are key. Authentic, real human relationships. And to get practical about that, Marina just gave us the tip, not just your org chart, but draw a stakeholder map, a stakeholder chart, or a decision chart of how things actually happen. And you can, I'm picturing the circles and the colored pencils or crayons that I would use, but you know, you can do it your way and figure out, okay, how does that actually happen? And then Marina, I love your point there. Ask those individuals, as you get to know them. I mean, it's probably not your opening question. Hey, what is it that motivates you, right? But as we're getting to know them, to ask those questions and find out, and then we have a powerful foundation place to start the process from.
Absolutely. A corollary to that, and a mistake that we see people make a lot, is people believe that things happen in meetings. And we would like to challenge that and tell you that nothing happens in a meeting. The work happens outside of the meeting. So if there's going to be a decision, you know, the thing to do is not to show up at a meeting and pitch everybody cold and then get their vote. That is a terrible idea. You need to understand who's going to vote, what the process is in a meeting, sure, but then go to the extent possible and sit down with each of those people one-on-one, talk to them about your idea, get their feedback, understand, you know, what their risk and incentive framework is relative to your feedback. And then there's after the meeting work too, about like, how exactly are they capturing what you said in the notes? Is it captured in a way that, you know, downstream will be flattering and helpful to you? This is especially helpful in things like condo associations and PTAs, where there's a lot of minutes and that, you know, follow you for years. In what order does the vote happen? Like, literally, you want to talk about a specific tactic? If you know one person always votes no, can you find some way to not have them go first? Find a different way. Is it, you know, a reverse alphabetical order, or use the random.org/lists randomizer, or something that you can do so that you can set the tone off right, so at least everybody hears one yes vote first. So there's a lot of strategies there around helping get decisions made in ways that bureaucracies really work, and not thinking that the path is you show up in a meeting, you make a pitch, you've won everybody over in the last 20 minutes, and they're all going to vote your way. That's really rare and unusual.
But just building on that, if I can, is that meetings can be really, really helpful for leaders to show enthusiasm for an idea and for other people to see the leader's enthusiasm. So Marina is spot on that the decision, you know, pitching something cold and the decision and the vote in a meeting as a spontaneous thing is not a great tactic, and we heavily discourage it. But if you do the pre-work before the meeting, and you can get someone to show enthusiasm, that's powerful for the troops, right? And so it does take all that that, and then this is a certain type of meeting. Like if it's a where you're trying to demonstrate a concept or initiative or a product or you know, some rollout or something like that. As long as you've done the hard work, not only with that person who's going to show that enthusiasm and they're determined to do that in that meeting, but that you've also spent time with the critics, and so you understand kind of what the what the hard questions are going to come up during that meeting too, because that can be a key piece to this.
You don't want to be surprised by those things. Go ahead, Marina.
Yeah, I have it's sort of a funnily named tactic, but that goes along with that. That is, you should stab people in the chest. And the concept behind there is you're going to have critics. You're going to have people that are going to disagree with you. And your job may not be to convince all of them to turn your way. You may not need all the votes, for example. But the thing you should never do is blindside your critics. So when I was going to disagree with someone in an important meeting, I made a point of it to sit down with my PowerPoint with that person one-on-one ahead of time and say, here, on slide 17, I'm going to say this about what you have to say. And that wasn't to get them to change slide 17, but it was so that they would build sort of a funny kind of trust with me, that they knew I wasn't going to blindside them or stab them in the back in front of a leader, even if we disagreed. And that goes really, really far towards building relationships over years, because you never know. I mean, boy, have we learned this, where one person that you stab in the back one day, what sort of role they're going to have next year or in 5 years, and how you're going to have to face them again. So we really discourage burning bridges and encourage stabbing people in the chest.
And as violent as it sounds, it's actually a very human-centered leadership technique. Is full of respect for that human being. And that's what's, and listeners, I know that you can't see Marina and Nick right now, but I got to tell you, hopefully you can hear the smiles in their words. They are passionate about this. They love doing this work. It's just oozing out of them. So I hope that you're hearing that, because it comes to me that there is a mindset, and you talk about this in a number of different ways throughout the book, is there's a mindset. And you mentioned it earlier, like, oh, hey, a lot of people when they first come in, they're like, oh my goodness, we're never gonna get anything done. This is impossible. And listen, we talk to leaders, clients all over the world. They're leading in large organizations. It's a matrixed organization. There's dotted line reporting and competing priorities, and all the priorities are important, and everyone's whittling down ideas to affect theirs. And it can feel really challenging to get people aligned or create change, but you obviously are passionate about it. You obviously believe in it. So how do we approach that mentally when we're looking at that world and going, okay, well, that is the world. You have some secret sauce in how you approach things mentally and emotionally that I'd love for you to share with our listeners.
Yeah. So one tactic along those lines, because we saw this problem a lot in government, was like, how do you fix the VA, for example, right? And now I work in foster care. How do you fix foster care? Like, that's so overwhelming that most people just kind of shut down because it's such an seemingly intractable, seemingly impossible problem. And I think we were very lucky to have front row seats to see, you know, the VA, is it fixed? Like, no. Does it now have a customer service satisfaction score of 90%? Yes. Like, are veterans now getting their benefits in instantly or within days or weeks instead of sitting in a backlog for 7 years? Like, yes. So that's made really huge monumental improvement. And so the tactic I'd focus on most there is called strangle the mainframe. It's a computing tactic. But my favorite analogy and way to describe it is a Harry Potter analogy, if you'll allow me. And if you have not heard Harry Potter, this is going to contain a spoiler alert, so you should skip ahead 30 seconds. So for the first 6 books of Harry Potter, everybody is trying to destroy Voldemort. Voldemort is the mainframe, the huge intractable problem that nobody can fix. And the way they try to fight him is head on direct. They just try to kill him directly and throw all their resources at it. And it doesn't work. He just gets more and more powerful. Half of Harry's family dies, and they create like billions of pounds of muggle property damage in the process, right? But what does work is when they discover the Horcruxes, that you can actually kill Voldemort piece by piece, slowly by taking one tractable thing, a necklace, a tiara, and destroying them. And then at the end, once you destroy it piece by piece, you're left with, you know, a little squiggly monster that you can get rid of. And so that's the approach that I've seen work again and again on these huge intractable problems. You can't fix the VA and you can't fix foster care, but you can say, what if I help build a better claim status tracker to solve this one problem? What if I solve this one problem really well? And if you keep biting off, like, you know, the elephant one bite at a time, as they say, in service of a larger North Star. And I think that's really important to have kind of both pieces. You want a vision of like, what could the future be? What does it look like if we have solved climate change, if we have fixed the VA, if we have fixed foster care, if we have fixed unemployment? And then what is one concrete step we can take in service of that goal? And then take another step and another step and another step. And bureaucracies, especially the larger they get, don't take this approach. They take a holistic planning approach. Like, we're going to have 10 years. We're going to map out every last requirement in a spreadsheet to get the solution perfect. And that literally has never worked in the history of time. What does work is getting one working solution out that in like 3 or 6 months, and then the next one and the next one. And that's really how you make change.
And so it might be, and you gave us a lot of policy oriented types of things, and it might be, you know, what's the one thing we can do to get our sales and marketing groups more aligned and working off the same page in the next 3 months? One thing. So breaking it down, getting incremental with our progress. And it strikes me that you're, and you talk about this in the book too, the way that you build momentum and positive energy and proof that change can happen by doing those one things at a time. And that actually attracts people, and you're building more relationships of the can do. So Nick, I want to come to you with that same question. What tactics or recommendations come up for you in terms of how mindset and mental emotional approach to this kind of work?
Yeah, it's a great question, David. And we have a whole set of tactics around building the team and cultivating the carass. Carass is a term in Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle book. And it's really about this informal team. And so when you get at this notion of large matrix corporations, for example, right, where you have lots of different business units and lots of different groups, you know, how can you recruit that informal team, those set of doers? We have a whole chapter about how do you find those doers, because there's slack in any large corporation or any large bureaucracy, right? And so there are absolute times when you can recruit them to work on your initiative, even if they're still working for their boss, or they can unblock your product launch or your marketing initiative or your sales campaign or something like that. And you just have to understand, well, you know, they still have to do their job, but sometimes they can help with this larger thing. Are there ways for them to plug in, right? And so there's a whole bunch of tactics around not just starting small, but also how do you build this informal team, because that also can help you get more resources and formal team members as well. And then that can help build some more visibility for whatever you're trying to get done. And it really is an iterative thing where if you're planning this thing 2 years out, you know, you're going to, who knows how that's going to happen. But if you can find ways to show progress, you're going to get a lot more enthusiasm, because people who are scrubbing in will get excited. They'll be able to see the impact of helping you. And you know, you're going to have to help them either in their career, in their, you know, with their boss. There's a variety of different tactics, which we talk about in the book, of making sure we call it pay the box guy. But essentially help the other person as much as you are asking them to scrub into your particular initiative.
You know, it strikes me that one of the elements that you're talking about, I always say leaders are in the hope business. I mean, that is the belief that tomorrow can be better than today if we will work together, and that when we demonstrate that progress, we're giving people hope that change is possible, that we can achieve things. And then, yes, as you say, Nick, as people scrub in. All right, so you brought up, I was going to come to this and ask you, it was one of the ones that I definitely wanted to talk about. So be sure to pay the box guy. It's a tactic in terms of, as we're building relationships and doing that work, tell us what that means.
Yeah, so it's a reference to the movie War Dogs, which is based on a true story of a defense contractor gone wrong, who was illegally selling a bunch of ammunition to the U.S. government that they were not supposed to be doing. And the one guy that was up to that knew what they were up to, the box guy, he owed him like $40,000 on a multi-$100 million contract, and he didn't pay the $40,000 to the guy with the boxes. And that guy called the FBI and, you know, crushed his empire. Now, I'm glad the guy got caught, definitely illegal activity. But along the way, you're going to owe people favors, right? People are going to help you. You may not even have explicitly asked them, but they may help you. And you may sort of like log in the you know, ledger in the sky that you kind of owe them a favor. And it's really important in a bureaucracy. People have long memories and they are around for a long time potentially. So if somebody does you a favor, or if you owe somebody something, or if you said, hey, if you help me with this, I'm going to get you that. You need to follow through on that commitment, or your next 50 projects are going to be in peril. And then sometimes if it's not possible, we also say, you know, like, you have to go back and talk to that person and give them a heads up. Hey, I thought I was going to be able to write you into this contract and get you this, you know, website contract that you needed, but I'm not going to be able to. I'm so sorry. Let's make a plan that I can still find a way to help you.
So as you're describing that, you know, I think anybody who's seen The Godfather or anything else where, you know, there's like, you know, someday I'm going to ask you a favor, you know, that kind of thing. And so like, that's not necessarily what we're talking about, but there is a principle of reciprocity that you're calling out for us, right?
Not just reciprocity, but trying to give first. I think the more that you can listen first and give first, and that's hard as leaders because we have all these things we're trying to get done. And yet, if we come in and listen to everybody else and try and help everybody else rather than get our own initiatives done, it feels like, well, you know, I'm on the clock here about trying to achieve some results in my organization. But you're ultimately going to be building a much stronger base if you take the time, not just to do a 30 or 60 day listening tour across the organization or across the business, but to also see how you can help people from where you are, whether you're running a few person shop or whether you have tens of thousands of employees. But you probably can find ways to not only, you know, help the top person, but also help sister organizations.
All right. So we've been talking about building relationships. We've been talking about investing in the other human beings and building our team. I'd like to move to getting into some of how we actually can create change now that we've got some folks that we have the relationships with. And there are, for our listeners, there are so many practical, tactical suggestions in this book. There are so many, I could not even, if I just spent the rest of this episode listing them, I might not make it. So, but we're only going to explore a few, but I want you to know that these are just a representative sample. And so I want to start with one called Look Between the Silos. And it's this idea in any organization, you've got these kind of firm structured silos and you know, healthy organizations. Yeah, the silos are really cooperative and working together, but there's still area between them. Why is that important when we're thinking about achieving and creating change or implementing ideas?
This is one of my favorite tactics because it's one that I continue using all the time. And people often think I'm like magical or have magical special abilities when I reveal the results. And I just want to be clear, like literally anybody can do this. It does not matter where you are. And the basic idea is bureaucracies of any size have silos. And not only that, but outside of your bureaucracy, there may be a flow of a claim or a sale, et cetera, that goes outside your bureaucracy and then comes back in. And it's almost never anybody's job to follow that process flow from start to finish. So like at the VA, it was, what is it like to process a disability claim? In unemployment, it's how do you process an unemployment claim? In a sale, it may be, you know, from start to finish, from your lead to your closing, signing a contract, what are all the steps? And if you can follow a real case, a real person, a real sale from start to finish, you're going to find this treasure trove of opportunity in the space between the silos. And nobody is ever defending the space between the silos. They're defending their own silo real hard against change. But the handoff space, there's usually nobody even there to fight you on making a change. And so that's often ripe for, depending on what your goal is, right? For inefficiencies, for helping make a tweak that downstream will help achieve your goal, for doing a data collection that's going to get you data that you need to make your argument. And in my kind of life, I do a lot of process reengineering. So most of the things I find are steps that we could eliminate entirely, or we could change to make employees' lives better, which increases employee satisfaction and retention, or to get throughput rates higher for end users. So mostly just anybody, wherever you are, even if you've just joined your company yesterday, you can follow a real claim or case or customer from start to finish, see what the process is like. And just in the course of doing that, you're going to find things between the silos that you probably want to improve and you may be able to.
I'm just fascinated by this. Marina, can you give us a specific example? I'm wondering if there's one that comes to mind for you, like from real life that you'd be able to share with us so that we can get a picture of exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. So one that happened to me a couple of years ago is I was helping a state improve their foster parent application process, which was taking hundreds of days. And in those hundreds of days, it meant kids were living in office lobbies or in group homes without homes that were available, but they just couldn't get through the paperwork fast enough. And so we were looking for ways to get that process down to something more like 2 or 3 months. And so I follow an actual application all around. It goes to the mailroom. I go to the mailroom. It gets faxed. I can't obviously go through a fax machine, but I show up on the other side of the fax machine and I see where it follows around the office. And at one point I'm watching a woman fill out the driving record request form on a carbon copy triplicate paper, which for your audience, if they have not used it, is sort of multicolored paper that you press really hard through to get 3 different copies underneath. And she's complaining, oh my God, the DMV, they live in the 19th century. I can't believe they still use this stupid carbon copy paper. And it takes 30 days to get a response back to it, which is a long time. And so I did what that woman was not empowered to do. And I wandered over the DMV and I said, hey, show me how you're processing this, you know, piece of paper on the other side, this carbon copy paper. And she said, oh, the carbon copy paper, you must've been at child welfare. Those people are living in the 19th century sending me this carbon copy paper. And we have an electronic system that they're not using. And so just by walking through that and identifying this broken handoff, we were able to shave 30 days off the process instantly. And everybody was happy to switch to the electronic system. Nobody wanted that carbon copy to stay.
Oh, Marina, I love that example so much. I mean, and those things exist in every organization, right? And it's something anyone can do, like you said. Follow the thing through, see where things are going. And you found an example of a place where everyone's happier with the outcome. It just needed somebody to take responsibility and say, this is what's possible and have some conversations. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I was just going to build on that. I do a lot of work in, now I'm in venture capital. So I work with a lot of growing software companies, both startups and scale-ups, as we call them. And this idea of looking between the silos can be applied there as well, including, you know, larger organizations. So if you think about marketing is trying to get leads, right? Especially in the demand generation function of marketing. And so they're trying to get marketing qualified leads that they hand over to sales. And then sales is looking at those leads and trying to turn those into opportunities and eventually close those. And this is mostly enterprise software in the realm that I deal with. Over the years, you know, software companies have thought about what's the handoff between marketing and sales, and how do you think of marketing qualified leads and sales qualified leads, and how do you kind of look between the silo there? But where people forget to look between the silo is once you sell the customer, then is the customer actually going to get any value from the software? Or is the customer going to churn? And what happens is, you know, people have been looking between the silos between marketing and sales, but maybe not as much between sales and customer success. And so then you know, the CFO says, well, why are certain customers churning? And it's because the marketing and the sales teams have been selling things that aren't necessarily going to add enough value, right? And so and if the marketing and sales are all incented about that initial sale and less on the long-term performance and use and value of that particular software, then that's not so great for the organization as a whole. And you can kind of tie that thread through of what is the customer journey across all of the different functions, customer success or account management, all the way to finance, and really try and trace their experience through. And that's one of the tactics that we preach in the book, is really trying to see things through the eyes of both a customer and an employee. So taking that human-centered approach and tracing those journeys, that will give you ideas on where you should be spending your time and what problems really need to be fixed, and then how to actually drive implementation.
Another powerful example. And since you bring it up, this is one of my favorite subjects, and I think this happens in many bureaucracies, large organizations, is you find that the incentives are don't always, and those might be systemic, they might be status, they might be financial, they might be, there's lots of different kinds of incentives, but they don't always match up. And sometimes they're in conflict from one group to the next. And so if you're in the middle of a bureaucracy and you start discovering these things as you're doing this process of following the journey and looking between silos, and you start to see those conflicts, how can you start to affect change as you identify those and go say, we've got a conflict here. These folks are incented this way. These folks are incented this way. And neither is necessarily ultimately serving our purpose the way we want it to. Now what?
Yeah, I mean, it can be a really challenging game of multidimensional chess there, right? But I think the first thing to do is to identify there's a conflict. And then, you know, I wish I had a pithy answer for you, but it really is going to matter on the situation to say like, okay, can I change one of the incentives? Can I change someone's risk framework? Can I move the project somewhere else where it's viewed as less risky and more desired? And then sometimes it becomes a timing issue where the incentives are so misaligned, you actually need to work on changing those upstream first. And then you can come back to your project later. Or sometimes you get lucky and then the person that was incentivized against what you're doing, you know, moves roles. I will say sometimes in my career, I have helped people get other jobs that they are also happy about, but because they were in the way from their first job. So there are different ways, depending on what the particular problems are that you're facing, to get the incentives more aligned. But I think that can be a really big, hopefully fun challenge to work through.
And I think you want to show the data too, right? Like you want to say like, look, this is how we've incented people and these are the results. And if you can show that data and tell a story about it, David, I'm sure your listeners are both data driven and great storytellers. But those are the two skills that we preach and say, look at what the incentives we've laid out. In this case, maybe it's for the salespeople, and then look at the behavior that we're getting in terms of them selling a certain set of customers that end up churning or not staying with us very long, and then be able to put that to a human being or to a persona or to some story that helps those numbers stick, because we don't remember numbers as well as we do a narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like to say a number for every story and a story for every number. And, you know, as you're talking through all of that, there are a couple different elements that even come in. Is one of Karen, my co-author partner, one of her tactics that she talks about was the advisability of having somebody else pitch your argument for you. That sometimes is more effective. If you know you're talking to the numbers folks and the CFO, go to the CFO or your financial director and say, hey, here's what I'm seeing. Is this what you, and if they say, yes, you're absolutely right, have them make that case because they have all of that authority behind them and people believe their numbers and more inherently than they might yours. Well, and it gets back to the stakeholdering and how decisions are made. And, you know, we start to see the different pieces here coming together. Yeah,
absolutely. And we talk about that in the chapter, Tailor Your Pitch, which is exactly what you're saying. If you're talking to someone that's a numbers person, you want to show them the numbers. And if you're talking to someone with more of an emotional bent or has different incentives, you want to make the pitch sound as aligned as possible to what they're incentivized by. And what a great idea if someone else can pitch for you. I mean, get someone in your carass, get them, read up and inspired and excited, and then get them to pitch it. Because depending on the environment, someone else's pitch may be heard much more readily than yours. And it's really, if you're focused on getting the job done, and like Nick said earlier, not on who gets the credit, having someone else pitch can actually be a dream.
You know, as you're talking about the pitch, one of the elements that you get into in the book are things not to do, some mistakes we want to avoid, and I'm laughing as I read some of these because have I made them. I mean, I've done the thing you mentioned earlier, one of my early executive roles. I go to the early board presentation and I just lay it all out there without any pre-meetings. I haven't stakeholdered anything and, you know, it was a disaster. Making emotional appeals to a bureaucracy. The bureaucracy has, you know, no emotion. It's a thing. Right. So what are some of the common mistakes that you see that people make when they're approaching trying to achieve change in a bureaucracy? If you had to go with two or three of the most common and then what we ought to be doing instead.
One that I also learned the hard way is the idea that I think people come into an environment that they see is broken, and the first thing they do is make a long list of the problems. And then they, you know, announce or share around the long list of problems. That was my first approach when I was trying to work on improving the VA's disability claim process when I worked at the White House. So I was an outsider. I wrote a very, very long report about all the things VA was doing wrong. I was correct about some of them, but some of them I actually didn't really understand the problem enough. And when I, over time, understood them, appreciated more of the nuances. But lo and behold, 3 years later, I'm the chief technology officer of the VA at this point, and I get my own report sent to me from the White House that I have to respond to. And it was miserable. It took me weeks. It was like virtually impossible to do. And boy, did I hate my previous self. And I think, you know, sometimes certainly if you see a problem that's, you know, putting someone at risk, you should definitely sound the alarm if you don't, even if you don't know what the solution is, by all means. But do not come into a new environment and see a problem and think that you're a hotshot for making a long list of what's going on or complaining about it without having a really deep understanding of what the actual problem is and also what you actually might be able to do to solve it.
Building on that, be careful of the word just, right? We just need to do this. We just need to do that, because the solutions, and usually in an organization of any size, while you do want to communicate simply and powerfully, the idea of we can just do this and that will fix our problem is usually a loaded word. And so we would definitely encourage folks to make sure that they understand people who have tried that particular idea. And understand why it hasn't worked. So people, you know, you may come in and say, hey, we need to be more customer centric. And then there may have been five initiatives prior to you arriving about the organization being more customer centric, right? And so you want to understand, even if the goal is good, why have we struggled as an organization to be customer centric? I mean, maybe we put it in our marketing lingo, but in terms of how our customers actually perceive us, right? That would be another big thing is to try and understand the history of the idea you're probably not the first person to come in with a particular initiative or idea, especially as a new leader. So try and figure out if people have proposed it before, why it hasn't worked. And if you can actually enlist people who have tried something similar in the past, And at the very least understand, and at the best, you know, get their active support, that's going to be quite powerful.
Fantastic. So many practical suggestions in such a short amount of time, and we're getting close to the end of our time, but I want to make sure we're talking with Marina Nitza and Nick Sinai. They are the authors of Hack Your Bureaucracy, Get Things Done No Matter What Your Role on Any Team. And I am learning so much. This has been a fantastic conversation. We're not done yet. But before we go to one or two more questions, can you tell us where to find the book, connect with you, all those good things? And we'll make sure and get all these links in the show notes. But where's the one place we should go to find connect with this book?
Yeah, if you go to hackyourbureaucracy.com, you can find links to buy it. The book is available everywhere the books are sold. And it also has Nick and my social media handles on Twitter and LinkedIn if you'd like to reach out directly.
And you can also come to leadershipwithoutlosingyoursoul.com, find this episode, and we'll absolutely have all of their social media handles, everything, so that you can connect there, as well as the link for the book website. All right. So, and we've got just a few minutes. I want to go one more tactic here, and then I want to ask a question about what has inspired you. So let's do our tactic first. There are so many, and like I said, hundreds, I couldn't list them all, but I want to just finish in terms of our tactics with what you call find your paperclip. Find your paperclip. There, it's a strong visual with powerful meaning. Explain the power, the meaning behind find your paperclip.
Yeah, so the original paperclip story, there was a blogger who had a red paperclip and through a succession of trades with people ended up with a house. And so he started with a paperclip, ended with a house. That sounds pretty good. And when I first started at the VA, recalling I had just been at the White House auditing the agency, and now here I am as a leader. So as you can imagine, that made me very popular. And so I was not necessarily welcome at a lot of meetings, where people were fearful that I would go write an audit report about what they were doing. And one day, a member of the executive secretary pool popped her head in my office, and nobody was popping their head in my office at that time, and said, you know, hey, Marina, have you seen Green PAC 42? And I said, I have no idea what that is, but boy, I will help you find it. What is it? And it turns out when members of Congress or other important people send a letter to the VA, it goes in a green folder, like a normal folder, and then it gets passed around the building. And anybody that wanted to weigh in on the official response would get their chance to like write literally with pen their feedback on the printed paper, and the green folder would then go back to get typed up. And so I saw this as sort of a real inefficiency because we have these amazing executive secretary pool that are running around a 12-story office building all day looking for green folders. And so I offered to make a little app on a Friday afternoon that printed a barcode on the front of each folder. And this being the VA, somewhere on the 10th floor, I found a closet of barcode scanners. So I passed those out with the folders. And now I was like a wizard to the executive secretary pool, who, you know, it's no secret, holds all the real power in every organization. And so I had helped them with this problem. And now they were going out of their way to find like the best spots on their executive's calendar so that I could get meetings. They were telling other people like, oh, you're having a technology challenge, you should definitely talk to Marina. And that was all from, you know, trading up my first paperclip, as it were. And over time, that became, you know, headcount, budget, a lot of political capital that I was able to spend in service of helping America's veterans. So I encourage everybody, wherever you are, you can find your paperclip. Maybe you organize really great events. Maybe you can write speeches. Maybe any other skill that you may have, use it somewhere in your environment to help earn the political capital from helping others, and see then what you can spend it on later.
I love that. Your paperclip is how you can help, regardless of whatever financial authority, whatever other resources you may or may not have in your organization, you have your ability to help other people. Fantastic. All right, let's go to our final final question here. I'd like to, if I think we've got about maybe a minute and a half each. And Nick, I'm going to throw this one to you first. As you think about all of the time in organizations, bureaucracies that you have spent, what is some of the most meaningful change, if you wanted to talk about one thing, one of the most meaningful changes you've seen accomplished in or through a bureaucracy?
Yeah, I think some of my favorite stories are some of the students I've mentored at Harvard. I'm an adjunct professor there, and it's great fun to teach them. And one of the students came to me and really wanted to change. He was looking for a summer job and didn't like the website on federal agencies, and came up with a nonprofit and started a better fellowship program called Coding It Forward. And they've placed hundreds of young technologists from across the country into federal agencies. That went so well that they actually started a new organization, actually part of the federal government now, called the U.S. Digital Corps, and they've recruited over 40 folks to serve in two-year fellowships in federal government. And so this is, you know, one student paired with a few others, and has attracted the support of hundreds of people across the federal government to really bring in the next generation of technical talent. And so it's fun to see that kind of mission, that passion, and creating a path for the next generation.
Wow, that is fantastic. I can see why that would be inspiring.
Yeah, mine would definitely be the evolution of the VA healthcare enrollment process. So when I started at the VA, there was a warehouse of 800,000 pending paper applications from veterans that were trying to get healthcare from the VA. Investigators had estimated 100,000 of those veterans died waiting for that paperwork to get processed. And the VA bureaucracy was approaching it like it always did, which was, I know we'll hire more people to type faster and get that paper typed faster, and that is how we will get them enrolled. But Emily and Marianne on my team used the tactic of getting out of the office and talking to real people, sat down with a veteran named Dominic, who was experiencing a lack of housing and had been trying and failing to get VA healthcare about 12 times. And with his permission, they recorded like a 2-minute video of him trying to enroll in the VA, a process that he described as like trying to go through a door spiked with IEDs. And it was a terrible, and we shared this video and it took off like wildfire, and it gave us just the opening that we needed, plus, you know, not wasting a crisis, of trying out a new mobile enrollment form. And since then, 2 million veterans have gotten healthcare pretty much instantly from their mobile phones. And every once in a while, I get to meet a veteran who got life-saving care from the VA as a result of that enrollment. And I would say nothing ever feels better than hearing that. That was worth all the years of, you know, banging my head against a bureaucracy. So.
Wow. Wow. Thank you both for sharing these stories, the hope that you both obviously carry with you, that belief in what's possible. And it's not just hope and nice, you know, fluffy words. It's backed up with research and science, your own experience, and a brilliant list of tactics. Once again, we've been talking with Marina Nitza and Nick Sinai, the authors of Hack Your Bureaucracy, Get Things Done No Matter What Your Role on Any Team. Cannot strongly enough recommend this book. We've only scraped the surface. There's so much more in here, but you both have inspired me, and you know, and I tend to approach these things with hope, but I'm feeling even more given what you shared with us today. Thank you so much for being guests today on Leadership Without Losing Your Soul.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, David.
It's been our pleasure. All right, listeners, get out there, find your paperclip, help other people change your bureaucracy, make that change happen, and be the leader you'd want your boss to be.
The UPS Store is making packing and shipping Easter gifts quicker than ever this year with UPS Air. How quick? Quicker than a walk around the park. Quicker than eating all the Easter candies. Quicker than finding a golden egg that you know is stuffed with cash. When you ship UPS Air at the UPS Store, your items arrive on time or your money back. Guaranteed at no extra cost. Exclusively at the UPS Store U.S. retail locations. Send Easter joy on time at the UPS Store. Visit theupsstore.com/airguarantee for full details. Terms and conditions apply.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.